The history of English government, especially in Ireland, is a history of playing off one prejudice against another. Divide and exploit. The British ruling classes made this a way of life, and you Yanks learned it at their knees.
Joseph Herity.
A professor of philosophies, Herity said in an exaggerated country accent. Terence Gannon had just reaffirmed over after-dinner tea of wild herbs that he had been a faculty member at Dublin's Trinity College. They sat on stiff furniture in the formal front parlour of the upper cottage. It was coming on to full dark outside, cloudy and hesitating on the edge of rain, and three candles had been lighted on saucers. They gave a spectral appearance to the traditional parlour, with its framed photographs and heavy wooden furniture. A peat fire hissed in the narrow fireplace, giving little heat but emitting puffs of pungent smoke when the wind backed on the chimney. Herity was showing some signs of unsteadiness from Gannon's poutine, but they had left the jug at the kitchen table when they went outside to collect the household's hidden weapons, and had not brought the liquor into the parlour. The guns, a rifle and a pistol, lay unloaded on the floor at Herity's feet. Gannon's voice had taken on the stillness of a man speaking in a haunted place the minute he entered the parlour, although he moved with old formality to make sure his guests were comfortable. "We fled here, to my family's old place, when it was no longer possible to stay in Dublin," he explained. "My brother-in-law there, he came up from Cork. It being no time to keep children in a city."
The brother-in-law, Wick Murphy, had brought his two surviving sons, Terry and Kenneth. Two daughters and a housekeeper had died before they left. His wife, Gannon's older sister, had died at the birth of Terry. Family history had come pouring out of Murphy's narrow mouth in relief at the discovery that Herity's party was merely being cautious and was not some of those terrible mean ones roaming about. John had taken a low stool and placed himself with his back against one side of the fireplace. The peat smell was stronger there, but the tiles at his back were warm. Father Michael and the children had taken a lantern and gone down to visit the graves in their little stone enclosure below the cottages. Murphy, somewhat drunker than Herity, sat on a rocking chair that creaked at his every move. He had the contented look of a man who had eaten and drunk well, and whose life was no worse than it had been the day before. Herity sat alone on the parlour settee, the machine gun suspended at his chest by a thin leather strap around his neck. He appeared amused by this all-male domesticity, and had been full of praise for Gannon's cooking. Gannon appeared to bear no resentment of Herity's rough treatment, but he had that look in his eyes of a man who could never again play in a game he was sure to lose. His shotgun had even been on safety when Herity took it from him. "He is a man waiting only to die," John thought. Supper had been fresh pork and greens, with marrows from the kitchen garden cooked in eggs. Herity and John prowled the area around the cottages and had inspected the byre while Gannon cooked. That look in Gannon's eyes. "We call that the suicide look," Herity had said. "How did these cottages escape?" John asked. He looked at the yellow light in the window of Gannon's kitchen. The burning and destruction appeared to have stopped at least a mile away. In the gloom of a cloud-covered evening, there was not a light to be seen in the entire valley.
"In the tumult of these times, 'tis a miracle," Herity said, his voice low. "But I do not think it was a church miracle. It may be that nothing was ever broken in Gannon's house. The fairies are liking that. There are strange things in this land. Let them say what they will."
"I don't like that brother-in-law," John said. He watched for Herity's reaction to this.
"Murphy, oh, he's a survivor. Many's the time I've seen his kind. They'll sell their souls for 10 more minutes of the breathing. They'll sell their friends and steal from the starving." "Oh, you're right, John. That Murphy bears watching."
John nodded. Herity tapped the Israeli machine gun on its strap around his neck.
"He'd like me gun, Murphy would.
Harrity looked back at the byre where he had hidden the shotgun up in the attic straw without its ammunition. "Did they say who's buried down there?" John asked, looking down at the grave's enclosure. "That little Berg's mother, two neighbor women who took shelter with Gannon, and then there was the daughter of one of them. Gannon's been here a while. You noticed the garden? That's been planted for a spell." John glanced back at the ridge, thinking of the watercourse beyond it where Harrity had found a body. "Do they know who it was, died up there? A stranger, so they say. But he was killed with a shotgun." "And they can't explain that rifle shot we heard," John said. "Now isn't that a mystery?" Harrity said. "Their pig was killed with a rifle, and not a rifle to be found." "You're sure it was a rifle killed the pig?" "I looked at it careful like when I was in the byre." "Ah, you know, John, we Irish learned many a clever way to hide weapons during the English ascendancy. I'm looking forward to the discovery of this one. Could it be in one of the cottages?" "I assure you it's not, and me being the cleverest searcher me father ever raised. No, John, it's under the byre, wrapped in oilskins and all safe in the grease. You saw how Murphy watched us from the window when we went out here, and there'll be a pistol with it. Murphy's a man who would favour a pistol. Gannon? Now he was a hunter once, or I miss my guess." Harrity rocked back on his heels, sniffing the air, the good smells of cooking coming from the open door of the cottage. John looked at the machine gun at Harrity's chest, remembering the feeling of it, the power there. "I have a curiosity about how you came by that gun," John said.
"Curiosity? Ah, that's what killed the cat.
From a dead man, you said.
This fine weapon was the possession of a political officer with the Paras in Ulster," Harrity said. "What a fine gentleman he was, with his little moustache and the blue eyes like silk. We knew all about him, we did. He was one of those English public school queers what caused their fine government so much lovely troubles. This one was left behind when the plague came. I found him hiding in an old barn near Rossley. He made the mistake of leaving his weapon behind when he went out to get water at the pump, and I slipped into the barn before he saw me."
"You told Father Michael he was dead."
"That I did. And him coming at me with a billhook. What could I do?"
Harrity grinned at him and patted the machine gun. "He had a whole bag of ammo for it as well." At supper, John watched Murphy and Gannon, observing the accuracy of Harrity's assessment. "How does Harrity judge me?" John wondered. It was an unsettling thought. He looked at Harrity seated across from him, busily spooning the marrow into his mouth. "He trusted me with the machine gun." It had been a test, John decided. From Harrity's reactions, John guessed the test had been passed. But it did not do to let your guard down with this man. They ate at the long table in the kitchen, a checkered red cloth on it, heavy dishes, water in tall glasses with ridged sides. The pork had been boiled with some wild leafy green that gave it a tart, rather pleasant flavor and cut the greasiness. Gannon had the kitchen manner of someone who had cooked for pleasure and not lost the touch.
"You'd make somebody a lovely wife," Harrity joked.
Gannon did not rise to the barb. Murphy had glowered at Gannon, pinched face drawn into a tight scowl, which changed to a smile when Harrity looked at him.
"Have you noticed, John?" Harrity asked, gesturing with his table knife. "How the passions are burnt out of the Irish. I do believe the madman himself could walk into our midst without harm, and him covered with the blood of all those millions. We'd only make room for him at table, and ask did he want a drink."
"It's not apathy," Gannon said. It was his first remark since bringing the food to the table. Father Michael looked down the table at Gannon, caught by the sharpness in the man's voice.
"Mr. Gannon is about to favour us with his grand opinion," Harrity said. "You listen when the professor talks," Murphy bridled.
It was then that Gannon first revealed his Trinity College background.
"I knew I'd seen you someplace," Father Michael said. "We're beyond apathy," Gannon said.
Herity sat back, smiling.
"Then would you tell us, Professor, what's beyond apathy?"
"The women are gone forever," Gannon said, his voice heavy. "The women are gone, and nothing, nothing will bring them back. The Irish diaspora is ended. We have all come home to die.
There must be women somewhere."
That was the older boy, Kenneth, who sat beside his father.
"And wise men like Mr. O'Donnell here will find a cure for the plague," Murphy said. "Things will come back to an even keel, Professor, depend on it."
"While we was still in Cork," Kenneth said, "I heard there was women in the old Lucan Castle, all safe and protected there by guns."
Through this exchange, Gannon merely stared down at his plate.
"Lots of those stories going around," Herity agreed.
"I believe what I see."
"You're a wise man, Mr. Herity," Gannon said, looking up at him.
"You see the truth and accept it."
"And what might that truth be?" Herity asked.
"That we are moving inexorably toward an edge where we'll drop off into nothing.
What's beyond apathy?
This thing some of you think of as life. This is already death."
"Welcome to Ireland, Yank," Herity said. "There's this Ireland the Professor has just described for us. Then there's the Ireland of the literary fancies. Was it one of those you thought you'd find, Mr. O'Donnell?"
John felt turmoil in his breast. He fell back on the pretense that had shielded him thus far.
"I came only to help."
"I keep forgetting," Herity said.
"Well, this is Ireland, Mr. O'Donnell, what you see around us right now. It may be the only Ireland there ever was, and it's suffering from 1,000 years of agony. I welcome you to it."
Herity bent once more to his eating. Gannon got up, went to a cupboard, and returned with a full jug of clear poteen. The acrid alcohol smell wafted over the table when he pulled the cork. John already had tasted this brew from the bit left in the bottle the boys had brought down from the ridge. He waved a hand to deflect Gannon from pouring him a glass.
"Now, John," Herity said, "would you be turning down the poteen the way you did the Guinness? You'll not be wanting us to drink alone."
"There's plenty to drink with you," Father Michael said.
"And you among them?" Herity asked.
Father Michael looked across the table where the silent boy was regarding him with alarm. Stiffly, the priest shook his head.
"No. I'll not be having any, thank you, Mr. Herity."
"Is it a temperance priest you've become?" Herity asked.
"Faith, what a terrible thing to happen."
He accepted a glass of the poutine from Gannon and sipped at it, smacking his lips in elaborate appreciation.
"Ah, it's the milk of the little people it is."
Gannon slid the bottle down the table toward Murphy, who took it greedily, pouring himself a large glass of it. Seating himself once more at the table, Gannon looked at Father Michael.
"Do you have family in these parts, Father?"
Father Michael shook his head from side to side. Herity took a long swallow of the poutine, put down the glass, and wiped his lips on the back of his hand.
"Family? Our Father Michael? Don't you know that all priests come from great, huge families?"
Father Michael cast a stricken look at Gannon.
"I've 2 brothers living."
"Living?" Herity said. "Now didn't you hear the professor?
This is not living."
He lifted his glass.
"A toast. Give Mr. O'Donnell a glass. He'll drink the toast with us."
Gannon splashed some poutine into a glass and slid it across to John.
"To bloody Ireland," Herity said, raising his glass high. "May she rise up from the dead and smite down the devil who injured us.
and may he suffer 1,000 deaths for every one he caused."
Herity downed his glass and thrust it out for a refill.
"I'll drink to that," Murphy said, and emptied his own glass, taking the jug from the table and refilling his own and Herity's.
Kenneth, whose age John estimated at 14, glowered at his father.
The boy pushed his chair back with a harsh scraping and stood. "I'm going outside."
"You'll sit there in your chair," Herity said. He gestured at the chair with his glass. Kenneth looked at his father, who shook his head. Sullen, Kenneth sank back onto his chair, but did not pull it up to the table.
"Where was you going, Kenneth?"
Herity asked.
"Outside."
"Out to the byre?
It being full of soft straw. Out there to dream of rolling in the straw with a young woman of your choice?"
"Leave him alone," Murphy said, his voice mild. Herity glanced at him.
"That I will, Mr. Murphy.
But it be an almost night outside, and us not having found the professor's rifle nor your pistol, I like to see everyone gathered around me." Herity drank deeply of his poteen, looking over the rim of his glass at Murphy and then at Gannon. Father Michael said,
"Joseph, you're a bad guest. These good people mean us no harm."
"Nor do I mean them harm," Herity said.
"But sure, and it's a caution how much harm you miss when you're careful about weapons."
Again, he drank deeply of his poteen. Murphy tried to smile at him, but managed only a twitch of the lips, his gaze fixed on the machine gun at Herity's chest. Gannon merely looked at his plate.
"Mr. Gannon?" Herity asked.
Not looking up, Gannon said,
"We will collect the other guns after the news."
"After the news?"
"It's time,"
Gannon said.
"I'll get the wireless. It's just behind me in that cupboard by the sink."
He stood. Herity turned in his chair, watching as Gannon went to the cupboard and returned with a battery-operated radio, which he placed in the middle of the table.
"We've a store of batteries," Murphy said. "Terence planned well when he came here."
Gannon turned a knob. The click was loud in the suddenly silent kitchen. Everyone was looking at the radio. It emitted a blat, then a soft humming, followed by a man's voice.
"Good evening. This is Continental BBC with our special edition for Great Britain, Ireland, and Libya."
The announcer's voice had the tones of Eton.
"As is our custom, we are beginning with a silent prayer," the announcer said. "We pray for a quick solution to this disaster, that the world may find new strength and a lasting peace."
The humming of the radio seemed loud to John, filling the space around them with its reminder of other people and other places, many minds focused on prayer. He tasted a sourness in his throat and glanced around the table. All heads were bowed except his own and Herity's. The latter winked when he met John's gaze.
"Did you take notice of the order?" Herity asked.
"Great Britain, Ireland, and Libya.
They may speak at first, but Britain's not great any more."
"It is the BBC,
Gannon said.
"And from France now," Herity said.
"Not an Englishman in the lot, though I grant they all sound like Oxford dons.
Americans, Frenchies, and Pakistanis, so I'm told."
"What does it matter?"
Gannon asked.
"It matters because it's a fact that no man of reason can deny. Those Yanks and Pakis and Frenchies have been brainwashed. England's first, then Ireland, and then the heathens."
"May our prayers be answered quickly," the announcer said.
"Amen."
His voice went on briskly.
"And now to the news."
John listened raptly. Istanbul was being put to the panic fire. New hot spots were identified. 31 cities, villages, and towns in Africa were named, Nairobi and Kinshasa among the confirmed. Johannesburg remained a radioactive ruin. In France, the loss of Nîmes was confirmed. A mob in Dijon had lynched 2 priests suspected of being Irish. In the United States, they were still trying to save most of New Orleans. The Swiss had retreated behind something they called the Lausanne Barrier, announcing that the rest of their country remained free of contamination.
"What a grand and glorious thing!" Herity exulted. "The whole world becomes Swiss. An antiseptic world with feather beds, and them soft as a young breast, eh, Kenneth?"
Herity stared at the boy, whose face became deep red. John felt only wonderment at the extent of what had been set in motion. It went far beyond expectations, although he could not say what those expectations had been, and, when he thought about this, he felt the stirring of O'Neill within. Still, he felt no remorse, only a sense of awe that Nemesis could enter the ranks of natural disasters. The announcer's list of places where the plague had struck seemed interminable. John realized then that this must be the most important part of the news. Places to avoid. How close is it coming? He was aware of the restrictions on travel. Special passes validated by the United Nations Barrier Command being required to cross most borders, and those borders no longer merely national ones. The Soviet Union announced no new hotspots, but satellite observation released by the United States reported evidence of new panic fires in the region southeastward from Omsk, almost to Semipalatinsk. Many towns and villages visibly burning, but Omsk appears as yet intact. The announcer interrupted this section with a late bulletin on the destruction of Istanbul, which he said had been successfully purified in a closed circle of attrition.
"So many new euphemisms for violence," Gannon muttered. He swept his gaze around the table, as though seeking something or someone not there. Did the madman think he was bringing peace and an end to violence?
John looked down at his hands. Peace had never been part of it, he thought. There had only been O'Neill's need to strike back. Who could deny the bereaved man that? John felt somehow like O'Neill's psychiatrist, understanding the man, neither condemning nor absolving. In the little notebook where Herity jotted the notes for his reports to Dublin, Herity would write that night, "If O'Donnell is the madman, he seems thunderstruck by the extent of disaster. Did he know how far his plague would range? Did he care? No signs of remorse. No indications of guilty conscience. How could he not react if he is O'Neill?" Mid-broadcast, there was a telephone interview with Dr. Dudley Wycombe Finch, director of the Huddersfield Research Establishment in England. Wycombe Finch could report no significant advances in the search for a cure, although there were promising lines of endeavor upon which I hope to report later. Asked by the announcer to compare this plague with similar historical disasters, Wycombe Finch said he thought it served no useful purpose to make such comparisons, adding, "Such mass destruction of people has not been seen for a very long time. This is destruction on a new scale, whose influence upon our descendants, if we are fortunate enough to have any, cannot be fully measured. In simple financial terms, there is no precedent, nothing with which to make valid comparison. In human terms..." Here, he fell into obvious sobbing. The BBC let it continue for a time, obviously milking it for effect, then... "Thank you, Doctor. We quite understand your reaction. We pray that your deep and obvious emotion will only strengthen your determination at the Huddersfield establishment."
"Strengthen your determination," Herity sneered, his voice thick with poutine. "The English tears could end a drought, I think. How can they even think of the financial cost?" Gannon demanded. It was the first spark of near anger John had seen in the man. "The game between God and Mammon having been called on account of half the players leaving," Herity said.
John looked at Father Michael, noting tears running down his cheeks. The branded forehead was a red smear in the lamplight. The BBC announcer was concluding his broadcast with another prayer.
that we may find it in our hearts to forgive all past injustices, setting the stage for a world in which mankind will find that true brotherhood and mercy which every religion exhorts from us. This prayer was provided by courtesy of the Buddhist Overseas Mission Church of San Rafael, California. Gannon turned the knob. The radio went silent with a snap. "We should save the batteries," he said.
"For what?"
his brother-in-law asked, his words slurred from the drink.
"To hear the fickin' news."
"Why,
there's no future in it."
The stranger came and tried to teach us their ways. They scorned us for being what we are. Galway Bay, an Irish ballad. In less than an hour there was to be a working dinner in the small private dining room off the White House mess, and President Adam Prescott knew he had not the slightest handle on a new approach to their problems. He knew, though, that he would have to appear confident and full of purpose. Leaders were supposed to lead. He sat alone in the Oval Office, the history of the place thick around him. Momentous decisions had been made here, and something of that seemed to cling to the walls. The desk in front of him had been given to Rutherford B. Hayes by Queen Victoria. The painting over the mantel across from him, by Dominic Sayers, showed the battle between the Bonhomme Richard and the Serapis. John F. Kennedy had admired it from this very position. The pier table behind him had been ordered and used by James Monroe. The chair beneath Prescott had been part of the same order. The chair felt like a prison to Prescott, and his back ached despite the chair's fine design by Pierre-Antoine Bellange. A stack of reports lay on the leather-bound green blotter in front of him, their tabs fanned out for him to read and extract what suited him. He had read them all, and they had succeeded only in amplifying his dismay. Information, he thought. What good is it? Prescott thought it all carried a grandiose power of inflation, automatic importance. If it was for the president's eyes, it must be not only important, but very important. Presidents must never be bothered with trivia. Information. Not facts, not data, not truth. It was accumulated out of human observations. People had seen the thing, or heard it, or felt it, and a digested version found its way to this desk that Rutherford B. Hayes had admired. Prescott glanced at the tabs protruding from the report folders. Breakouts. New plague pockets were being called hot spots by the media. There no longer was any question of evacuating people. Where could they go? Strangers were dangerous. People who had been away from home were dangerous. Good friends returning from far places no longer were good friends. Railroad lines were being torn up. Airports were strewn with wreckage to block the landing strips. Roads were blockaded and guarded by armed men. Bridges were blown down. A report in front of Prescott said every curb of Spaghetti Overpass and rerouting on the A-11 from Paris had been dumped onto the highway by expertly placed charges of explosives, and the lack of transport was creating starvation pockets. The Maquis had remembered what they learned for another war, but they had forgotten that food traveled the highways too. It was no better at many places in the United States. Men dared not go foraging, and food was a serious problem in cities and even in the countryside. New York was getting by on what it grew along the fire barrier, thankful for a reduced population and warehouses stocked with canned goods. Washington, D.C. had an estimated 2 years before the belt tightened. It was getting by on emergency reserves stockpiled against atomic attack, plus gardens planted on its lawns and open spaces. Washington and its ring of bedroom communities remained plague-free, largely because General William D. Caffrin had acted on his own to spread a flamethrower cordon around the city, backed by tanks and infantry, with orders to shoot and burn intruders. He had sent suicide squads then against every contaminated pocket his ruthless methods could ferret out.
Quarantine stations had been installed at all entry points, all served by women volunteers flown in from regional prisons and constantly observed by remote TV. Prescott slid the report-tabbed tribute from the pile on his desk and opened it. Weird. That was the only word for it. No doubt this was an outgrowth of the Barrier Command's free boats policy, sending in supplies to the Irish Finn Saddle and the English border beaters. The free boats had seemed a good idea at the time. Small, self-propelled, radio-guided craft dispatched into Kinsale, Howth, Liverpool, and other port stations by the Barrier Command, carrying newspapers, food, liquor, small arms, ammunition, clothing. A simple radio signal destroyed the boats when they had completed their mission. Finn Saddle. Border beaters. Prescott shuddered at some of the things he had heard about Finn Saddle behavior. But tribute? Dublin was threatening to remove the Finn Saddle from its guardian posts along the beaches, and to mount an active attempt to infect other regions outside their borders if their demands were not met. Prescott scanned the page in front of him. Ireland wanted the Viking plunder returned. All of that priceless accumulation from the museums of Denmark, Norway, and Sweden was to be brought back and sent in on the free boats. All of the wealth stolen from us by the barbarians will be interred at Armagh, the Irish said. Interred? They spoke of plans for a great ceremony full of pagan overtones. Norway and Sweden had signaled immediate agreement, but the Danes were showing reluctance. If they ask this now, what might they demand next? Damn greedy Danes. Prescott scribbled a note on the margin of the page. Tell the Danes they've been outvoted. They comply or we'll do it the hard way. He signed it. The order would have to be expressed more diplomatically, of course, but the Danes were good at sensing the iron intentions behind diplomatic double-talk. Small nations learned that sensitivity very early. England's demands were even stranger at first glance. Although coming after the Irish broadcast and couched in more urbane terms, they were backed by a similar threat. Libraries. When this time is only bitter memory, we wish to be the nation of published treasures. Books, manuscripts, charts, and religious documents, artists' sketches and paintings. We want the originals from wherever they may now be. You will be allowed to make suitable copies. His security analysts called this canny. Civilized nations would think long and hard before incinerating such treasures, should it come to that. The trouble was, this was no longer a civilized world. Prescott turned to the tribute section of England and at the top wrote a single word, comply. He initialed it. Libya had not joined this new game, but there remained a question whether Libya had any sort of central government at all. Satellite observation said the country lay in ruins and the population might have been reduced to a scant fraction of its former numbers. And what had that been? 3 million? All of North Africa was a shambles. Sterilization squads, the new SS they were being called, had put the torch to every population center bordering Libya and across the land from the Suez to Cap Blanc, moving in ahead of the cobalt barrier that now ringed the doomed land. And what about Israel? Prescott pushed the folder-tabbed Brazil aside, deciding to take it with him to the dinner session. North Africa remained a primary concern. Survivors were massing in Chad and Sudan, their intentions obvious. There was a new jihad about to begin. Neutron bombs, Prescott thought. The only answer. The area was outside that prescribed by O'Neill. And what difference did it make now whether O'Neill prohibited atomics in Libya? That nation no longer existed. The anchorman on the previous night's final news had not been privy to Prescott's satellite information, but he had obviously heard. We have only a terrible silence from that land. Prescott put the tribute folder aside and stared sourly at the spread of tabs. Words on paper. Could any of it really touch the core of this disaster? China appeared to have the India problem in hand, but there remained that bitter schism between China and the Soviets. That had to be a key subject at this working session. He glanced at his watch. A half hour yet. A war in the Far East could be the final disaster. Refugees, loss of central control, no way to impose a tight system of observation and quarantine on the movements of large groups. The fragility of the human condition felt overwhelming to the president. He experienced a tightness in his chest, his breathing short and quick. The tabs on the reports took on a life of their own, the letters large and burning, each one conjuring new potentials of extinction. Denver, Ulaanbaatar, Peron, Omsk, Tsiempo, Luanda. Slowly, the tight feeling subsided. He considered calling in his doctor, but another glance at his watch told him there wasn't time before the dinner session. Blood sugar problem anyway. His eyes focused on a folder. Success question. Yes, that was one of the more serious concerns. What assurance did they have that Ireland or England would share any discovery? What if they found a cure and blackmailed the rest of the world? And if that madman O'Neill were really hiding in England or Ireland? The question would have to be raised at this dinner, and the agents they had managed to place in both countries were not enough. Some other means of on-site surveillance had to be found. The buzzer beneath the desk sounded. Two peremptory calls. They would be standing out there, waiting. Putting both hands on the desk, he heaved himself to his feet. As he stood, a band of agony encircled his chest. The room wavered like a scene underwater, whirling and whirling around him. He heard a distant hissing ring that filled his awareness. There was no sensation of falling, only the blessed rise of unconsciousness that took away the terror, the agony, and the view under the side table beside his desk. A brass-footed and fluted wood pillar deeply scratched where one of Andrew Johnson's spurs had gouged the rosewood. Violence and piety cannot conjoin. They are not of the same stuff. Nothing binds the two. Not joy, not suffering, not even the living death that some mistake for peace. The one comes from hell, the other from heaven. In piety you find grace. In violence you are forever graceless. Father Michael's Sermon. Feeling oddly displaced, John went to sleep that night in an upper bedroom of Gannon's cottage, clean sheets and a lumpy mattress. He had one short stub of a candle to light him to the room, which smelled of soap and some flowery perfume. There was a single wooden chair, a low dresser, and a standing wardrobe that reminded him of the one in the Hotel Normandy. O'Neill within had become quiescent, moving deeper, more remote, and, John felt it, satisfied. He had seen what he had seen. While preparing for bed, John thought about the drinking session at the supper table. It had resumed in the kitchen after the herb tea in the parlor. Herity and Murphy seated across from each other, drinking glass for glass, staring at each other with strange intensity. Father Michael had sent the silent boy to bed and had taken a position at the end of the long table, as far as he could get from the drinkers, but his eyes were on the glasses of poutine, not on the men. Gannon had sent the other children off to their beds and had busied himself cleaning up at the sink. John, bringing his cup from the parlor, had handed it to Gannon and seated himself near the priest. Looking at the branded forehead, he thought about the question of the priest's family. "Where are your brothers, Father Michael?" Father Michael turned a hunted look toward John. "You said you have two brothers."
"I've not heard of Matthew since the plague, but he lived in Clun, and that's a ways off. Timothy... Little Tim has built a hut beside his wife's grave at Glasnevin, and that's where he sleeps now."
Murphy cleared his throat, his attention on the empty jug that Gannon was removing to the sink.
"We'll solve it, by God. I know we will."
He cast a bleary glance around the table.
"Where's my Kenneth?"
"Gone to bed," Gannon said.
"I'll yet dandle me grandson on me knee," Murphy said. "Everyone clings to a dream such as that," Gannon said, leaning against the drainboard, "until something overwhelms them. It's the dream of personal survival, a victory over time. Some submit to religion, or make a daring assault on the secrets of the universe, or live in hope of genie chance. It's all the same thing."
John could visualize Gannon standing in front of a classroom delivering those portentous phrases, and in that same pedantic tone. Gannon had said that same thing many times, and in those same words. Murphy looked admiringly at his brother-in-law.
"The wisdom in that man."
Herity chuckled.
"You know what the Yanks call your professor's genie chance? They call it the blonde in the Cadillac automobile."
Laughter set his hand trembling, spilling some of the poutine from his glass.
"It has other variations," Gannon said. "The magic number, the winning ticket on the sweeps, the treasure that you stumble upon in your own backyard." "Such things happen," Murphy said.
Gannon smiled sadly.
"I think I'll go down to the graves." "Where did you leave the lantern, Wick?" "On the back stoop." "Would you care to accompany me, Father Michael?"
Gannon asked.
"I'll wait for morning, and bless them then,"
Father Michael said.
"He's no mind to visit graves in the night, Father Michael hasn't,"
Herity said.
"The ghosts now, and them ranging across the whole land in these perilous times."
"There's no such thing as ghosts," Father Michael said.
"There's spirits. And sure, and we all know there's witches, don't we, Father Michael?"
Herity peered at the priest with owlish glee.
"And fairies now. What about them?" "Dream of anything you like,"
Father Michael said.
"I'm going to bed." "The first room to the right at the top of the stairs, Father," Gannon said. "Sleep with the angels, God willing."
Gannon turned and let himself out the kitchen door. On impulse, John followed, finding Gannon there lighting a slender lantern with a kitchen match. Clouds covered the sky, and there was a feeling of mist in the air.
"Tell me, Mr. O'Donnell, are you accompanying me because you fear I have other weapons hidden out here?"
"Not me," John said. "And don't mind Herity. He lives by his suspicions."
"A soldier, that one," Gannon said. "A provo, or I miss my guess. I know the type."
John felt an abrupt emptiness in his stomach. Herity. One of the provisional IRA. There was the sound of truth in Gannon's words. Herity was one of those who made the terrorist bombs and slaughtered innocents such as Kevin and Mairead and Mary O'Neill.
"I will open my heart and pray as never before that you shall reach Killaloe safely and there find a cure for the plague," Gannon said.
In the morning when he awakened in the cold upstairs room, John went to the window and looked down on the stone enclosure around the graves. He could just see it past the corner of the other cottage. The night before, the stone enclosure had been a ghostly wrath in the yellow light of Gannon's lantern. The silence waited. An owl had floated past, and Gannon had not even looked up from his silent praying. Only Herity had been at the table when they returned to the house. He sat there still nursing a half-glass of the poutine. It had occurred to John then that Herity was one of those Irish prodigies who could imbibe ruinous amounts of alcohol with only minimal evidence of it. That was a good thing to know. John realized he was seeing Herity in a new light since Gannon's assessment. A provo. No doubt of it.
"It's glad I am you've returned safely from the ghostly night," Herity said.
There's wild animals about, you know. A few pigs running loose,
Gannon said.
I was speaking of the two-legged kind,
Herity said. He drained his glass. Standing slowly, deliberately, Herity said,
to bed, the sleep of the dead. I'll give you the dawn for an evening's yawn and one small bullet of lead.
He patted the machine gun at his chest. As he stood at the upstairs window in the dawn, John became aware of someone walking up through the lower meadows and stopping at the graves. John was a moment recognizing Herity, and then by the machine gun, which became visible when he rounded the stone walls and peered up at the cottages. Herity was wearing a green poncho. Something from his pack, John thought. He hurried to dress, hearing the sounds of people moving downstairs, smelling lard heating in a pan. The odor of the tea herb mingled with peat smoke. Breakfast was a silent time. Boiled eggs and soda bread. Murphy appeared bright-eyed, showing no effects of the night's drinking. His eyes winked with delight at the food Gannon placed in front of him. After breakfast, they followed Father Michael down to the graves for the promised blessing. The air was still cold and misty, gray light through heavy cloud cover. John brought up the rear, the silent boy just ahead, clutching the blue anorak close around his neck. John found himself interested in the silent boy's reaction to this ritual. These were women buried here. Had the boy attended the funeral of his mother? John felt no emotion as he wondered these things. There had been a coldness in him the previous night as he felt O'Neill receding. O'Neill had struck the ones who injured him. He had done it through his successors. Through me, John thought. Had O'Neill imagined such a scene as this? There was no memory of such a thing, no inner movie to recount it. Cold I was when I did the thing. Cold and murderous, not caring who I hurt. Nothing had mattered except the striking out. Father Michael finished his office of the dead. Looking at Gannon, he said, I shall pray for you and for your loved ones. Gannon lifted his right hand limply, dropped it. He turned and plodded toward the cottages, moving as though each step were painful. Go along, Father Michael, Herity said. Mr. Gannon has promised us provisions for the road. We must be getting Mr. O'Donnell to Killaloe, and it's a long tramp over the hills. Father Michael put a hand over the silent boy's shoulders and followed Gannon. Murphy and the three other boys fell in behind. Mr. Murphy, how about a bit of that pig to take on the way with us? Herity said. As Murphy stopped and turned, Herity took off at a trot up the hill. The two men headed at an angle for the byre. John followed the others into the cottage. What was Herity doing? He had not given in to a sudden urge for pork. It was something else. Gannon was already busy in the kitchen, Father Michael helping him, when John entered. It felt warm in the cottage after the outside chill. There was a pair of tall, military binoculars on the kitchen table.
I've given my binoculars to Father Michael, Gannon said. Wick brought his when he came from Cork, and there's no need for us to have two pairs.
Father Michael sighed.
It's a sad truth, John, but the farther ahead we see, the safer we are in our going.
Gannon had found a small blue and yellow hiker's pack with one patched shoulder strap. He put several chunks of soda bread around the outside and packed fresh eggs in the nest thus formed.
There's a jar of sweet jelly and a bit of lard, he said. I've left room in the top for the pork when Wick brings it. You're a kind man, Mr. Gannon,
Father Michael said. Gannon nodded his head at this and turned to look at John.
Mr. O'Donnell, I shall pray again that you gain safely to Killaloe, and that your hand helps us there. You have come across the water in our time of need. I'll not have you misunderstanding the way of us, nor how much we appreciate your coming here.
Father Michael busied himself arranging the food in the pack, not looking at Gannon or John.
I've talked to Mr. Herity this morning, Gannon said, and I've a better understanding of your party.
He's told me the sorry way you were treated by the Beach Boys. I think there's a dispute among the soldiery about the way you were greeted, Ireland needing wisdom such as yours these days. I'm thinking Herity has come along to see you safely to Killaloe. He's a rough man, but there's times such men are needed.
John rubbed at the stubble on his chin, wondering how he should respond to this pedantic outburst. Herity and Murphy entered then, Herity with his pack already slung over his left shoulder, the machine gun riding in the cradle of his right arm.
"The pig's already turning bad," Murphy said. "It needs ice this time of year," Herity said.
John looked at the two men, sensing a subtle change in their behavior toward each other. There was some kind of an understanding between them.
"It's a long tramp," Herity said. "Best be on our way."
He glanced at Father Michael, who was stuffing the blue and yellow pack into his larger pack, preparing to shoulder it.
"Call the boy, Father, and we'll be on our way."
"He's welcome to stay here," Gannon said. "If you—"
Father Michael shook his head.
"No, he'd best come along with us."
"The father has formed a special attachment for the lad," Herity said.
He made it sound insinuatingly evil, grinning as he spoke. Scowling, Father Michael took up his pack and brushed past Herity out the door. They heard him calling the boy. John followed, feeling oddly put out by Herity's manner.
"What do I care how he treats the priest?" John wondered.
He puzzled over this as they said their goodbyes and walked up the hill toward the farm track that led to the valley road. When they rounded a screen of trees and no longer could see the cottages, Herity called a halt. The sky was already brighter, even a few patches of blue overhead. John looked back the way they had come, then at Herity rummaging in his green pack. Herity pulled out a small, short-barreled revolver and a box of ammunition. The gun glistened with oil.
"This is a gift from Mr. Murphy," Herity said.
"It's only a Smith & Wesson five-shooter, but it'll fit in your pocket, John. Best go armed these days."
John accepted the revolver, feeling the cold oiliness of it.
"Into your hip pocket, and pull the sweater over it," Herity said.
"There, that's the way."
"Murphy gave this to you?" John asked.
Herity handed him the box of ammunition.
"Yes. Stuff this in your side pocket. There was two of them Gannon didn't know about. T'other's a big Colt monster you wouldn't want to be carrying, it being heavy as a tub of lead and not as useful."
Herity returned his pack to his shoulder and started to turn, but stopped as a shot sounded behind them. Father Michael whirled and would have run back to the cottages had Herity not stopped him with a firm grip on the arm. The priest tried to pry Herity's fingers away.
"They may need our help, Joseph."
"You haven't thought it through, Father. What are the possibilities?"
"What do you—"
"Another pig?" Herity asked.
"I've returned all their weapons and the ammunition." "If it's a pig, fine. They'll be eating a grand meal tonight and Mr. Gannon cooking it. If it's intruders, our friends are well armed. And that was a pistol shot, I remind you."
Father Michael looked around him warily, listening. The woods around them were silent, not even a bird call, and the valley below, still shrouded in morning mist, was immersed in primal silence.
"If it was Gannon ending his miseries, you'd not be praying over him anyway," Herity said. "You're a cruel man, Joseph."
"That's been observed by better men than you."
Herity turned away and headed up the track toward the road.
"Come along now."
The silent boy edged close to Father Michael, tugged his arm, and looked after Herity. Fascinated, John watched the indecision in Father Michael become resignation. The priest allowed the boy to lead him up the track in Herity's wake. John fell in step behind them, feeling the pistol heavy in his rear pocket. Why had Herity given him this weapon? Was it trust? Had Gannon assessed it correctly? Was Herity assigned to escort John to the lab at Killaloe? Then why hadn't he said so? And why were the priest and the boy tagging along? Herity stopped at the road, waiting for them. He looked to the left where the road edged the valley floor, curving toward another tree-bordered notch at the upper end. John stopped beside Harrity and found himself caught by the diffused vista, the design of this landscape to control his eyes' movements. Patchwork earth and groves in the middle distance, a willow-bordered stream there, then more distant fields and up to the thin gray sliver of road into the other notch. The clouds in the eastern sky presented a rose-tinted border to the scene. Harrity said, "This land holds our history in its palm." He pointed. "That notch over there? O'Sullivan Bear and his pitiful leavings of an army went through there." Something in Harrity's tone held John, forcing him to see this land as Harrity did, a place where armies marched back and forth, and where, not long ago, men who were hunted by the Black and Tans had fled through darkness to be hidden in the cottages of the poor. Grandpa Jack McCarthy had told the story many a time, always ending, "'Tis the fate of the Irish always, to be driven from pillar to post.' Father Michael stepped around Harrity and set off briskly on the valley road. The boy trotted occasionally, sometimes jumping to catch a leaf from an overhanging bough. Harrity waited until they were almost 100 meters ahead before nodding to John and setting off after them. "Safer to keep some distance between us," he said. He gestured with the machine gun at the two ahead. "Look at that mad priest, would you know? He wants to make another she-guts out of that lad. And the lad, he wants only his dead mother back to him like Lazarus out of the grave." Out of the corners of his eyes, Harrity watched John, looking for some effect from these words. There was nothing. Well, the gloves would have to come off sometime soon. He thought of the message he had left with Wick Murphy to pass along to the Finn Saddle horse post for transmittal to Dublin. "I've convinced him he's fully trusted. We'll be taking him now past McRae's place and see how that works on him. Will he try to spread the plague? Send word to Liam and warn him to be on watch when he passes us along. Let Kevin O'Donnell think of the cleverness in this plan." "Why do you keep calling Father Michael mad?" John asked, thinking of the cowled figure at the clothing hut. "Were all priests mad now?"
"Because he's mad as the Hatter," Harrity said. "I've a friend, Liam Cullen, calls them all Lucans of the Liturgy, him being a man who likes to turn a curious phrase."
"Lucans of the Liturgy?" John asked. "What's that supposed to—" He broke off, stumbling on a rock, then caught his balance.
"You've not heard of Lucan the Monster? Him has ordered the charge of the Light Brigade. Not to be confused with Patrick Sarsfield, the Earl of Lucan, who defended Limerick after the Boyne. When he took his Irish brigade to King Louis in France, they routed the Coldstream Guards at the Battle of Fontenoy."
"The Wild Geese," John said.
"Ah, you know the brigade, then. But it's the other Lucan Liam means. Him as drove 40,000 Irish farmers from their land, most of them to their deaths. And what does English history memorialize? 600 English bastards, and them stupid enough to follow the orders of such a monstrous man."
"What does that have to do with priests?"
"Don't you hear them quoting scripture to our despair and destruction? Obedience. Into the valley of death, he says. In we go. Leave your land, the hell beast says. Off we go. They move us all to suicide, and they won't even pray over us. Like docile lambs, we say, 'Give us a place to dig our graves.' Liam's right. Lucans of the Liturgy."
John looked away to the low scrub on his left, the rock wall covered with lichen patches here. How carefully Harrity watched him. What was Harrity seeking? "Only the ones with a will to fight back are deserving of our tears," Harrity said.
"Have you the will to fight back, John?"
John tried to swallow past a lump in his throat. Then,
"You see me here? I didn't have to come."
"But I did have to come," he thought. Harrity appeared curiously moved by John's response. He patted John on the shoulder.
"That you are. You're here with the rest of us. And why are you here?"
Herity shook his head, knowing he had to assume this was O'Neill, the madman himself. And if he was O'Neill, Herity forced himself to face it.
"The bomb we made killed his wife and Wayne's. He fought back. Damn his soul to hell."
Presently, Herity began humming a tune. Then he sang,
"Oh, my dark Rosaline, do not sigh, do not weep. The priests are on the ocean green, they march along the deep."
He broke off and cast a probing stare at John beside him, that bald head outlined against the valley mist, the lean, bearded face without a change of expression in it. With a sigh, Herity marched in silence for a time, then he picked up his pace, forcing John to quick-step for a moment to keep up.
"There's priests marching everywhere,"
Herity said, nodding at the black-suited figure ahead of them.
"And more than wine from a royal pope in their bags. Though I wish I had some Spanish ale this moment to give me hope and glad me heart."
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.